Okay, so we, so the fact that when I'm touching it, it goes.
Yeah, you can mute the mic.
Yeah, I'll mute.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I'd like to formally call to order the first meeting here of the Kern County Measure K Citizens Oversight Committee. This is a special introductory and training meeting, and I'd like to just formally thank all of our committee members for taking on this assignment. Thank you for being here. This has been, this is really a kind of a monumentum and kind of historic thing for Kern County. We've never had a special tax like this enacted. We're excited about the ability to actually bring some value and improvements, particularly in our unincorporated areas of Kern County, and utilizing these funds over the next several years to accomplish really some great things that we think we can get done. So you all play a very important role in this as our CAO and myself, the sheriff, the DA, and others went around this county to talk about Measure K and the needs for it, the fiscal really urgency behind the needs for it because of the changing economy here in Kern County, particularly the impacts on our energy sector, oil and gas, first and foremost, and just the stagnant revenues that the county's experienced for some time. Really, the role of public transparency and accountability was first and foremost. So it was people wanted to know, first they wanted to understand, you know, why was this needed? But then, okay, if we move forward and authorize this local tax, you know, how do we know how this is going to be spent and the things will get done that are important to us? And so we've put in several different accountability and transparency measures into the ordinance, one of which is this body that you're on here today, and that's the Citizens Oversight Committee. So you play an important role. We appreciate you being here. I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of roles and responsibilities as we get to that item on the agenda. Today is really going to be kind of organizational in nature. So we've got some training that County Council is going to provide, as well as just bylaws and things of that nature. So we're not going to talk about money today. We'll be back at our next meeting to do that. And I'll talk a little bit about that process as well. But I just want to express my thanks and our boards and CAO's thanks for you all taking the time out of your schedule and your lives to be able to be here with us and help us, you know, really create value here for the community and bring improvements to our unincorporated parts of Kern County. So thank you. So with that said, I'd like to ask our clerk to go ahead and take roll.
Committee member representing District 1, Karen Zuber.
Present.
Committee member representing District 2, Jeffrey Kermode.
Here.
Committee member representing District 3, Cheryl Barbage.
Here.
Committee member representing District 4, Regina Houchin.
Here.
And committee member representing District 5, Laura Guerrero-Salgado.
Present.
Thank you.
All right. With that, brings us to item number 2 on our agenda. This is adoption of the bylaws. The bylaws were distributed to you all in advance. They're also included in our agenda packets here today. I'm happy to entertain any comments or questions from your committee regarding the proposed bylaws. And if there are none, then we would accept a motion to adopt those.
Move adoption.
Second.
We'll take a roll call vote. We have a motion by Cheryl Barbage, second by Jeffrey Kermode, to adopt the bylaws. Commissioner Zuber?
Approved.
Commissioner Kermode?
Aye.
Commissioner Barbage?
Aye.
Commissioner Houchin?
Aye.
Commissioner Guerrero-Salgado?
Aye.
The motion is approved. All ayes.
Okay, item 3 on our agenda is the election of a chairperson and vice chairperson. So in accordance with the bylaws that you just adopted, you need to select amongst the five of you a chairperson and vice chairperson to fulfill those roles and responsibilities, primarily being the one who is going to take over running these meetings.
No volunteers?
Do we make nominations, or how shall we do this?
Nominate.
I would like to nominate Cheryl Barbage for the chairperson.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any other nominations for the chairperson?
Why don't we just look at each other?
seeing none, Clerk, do you want to go ahead and take a motion on the appointment of the chairperson?
Yes. Do we have a second?
This is Laura, I second.
Thank you. So we have a motion and second to elect Cheryl Barbage as the chairperson, and we'll do a roll call vote. Commissioner Zuber?
Aye.
Commissioner Kermode?
Aye.
Commissioner Barbage?
Aye.
Commissioner Houchin?
Aye.
Commissioner Guerrero Salgado?
Aye.
Motion carries, all ayes.
Thank you. I think.
Okay, Chairperson Barbich, I'll go ahead and turn the meeting over to you to accept nominations for the vice chair.
For the vice chair. So are there any nominations for vice chair of this esteemed committee? Can we have four vice chairs?
I would like to nominate Jeffrey Kermode.
Is there a second?
This is Laura, I second.
Do we need a roll call on that?
Yes, we do. All so right. We have a motion by Commissioner Houchin, second by Commissioner Guerrero Salgado, nominating Jeffrey Kermode as the vice chairperson. And we'll do a roll call vote. Commissioner Zuber?
Aye.
Commissioner Kermode?
Aye.
Commissioner Barbich?
Aye.
Commissioner Houchin?
Aye.
And Commissioner Guerrero Salgado?
Aye.
Motion carries, all ayes.
So at this time, we'll look to any public comments. Seeing none, we'll move to roles and responsibilities. Mr. Zervis, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I wanted to take a few minutes to just talk about roles and responsibilities stemming primarily from the ordinance itself and the resolution that the Board of Supervisors adopted regarding your oversight committee in general. And so I'm going to just kind of go through some bullet point, kind of high level, kind of roles and responsibilities that all of us are going to play as these meetings proceed, and then talk a little bit about our budgeting process and give you an idea of what to expect, you know, over the next few meetings as we move forward. So obviously the Board of Supervisors acts at a countywide level, so they oversee not just Measure K, but all of the activities of the county, including Measure K. So that'll ultimately include budget adoption of all county funds and a Measure K budget at the end of the day. It is the Board of Supervisors that will formally adopt and approve that spending plan. They approve contracts. So as we talk about different programs and things we're going to be implementing, as staff goes out and departments go out to implement those programs, the contracts and the agreements, the things that need to get put in place to actually carry out those activities, fall under the Board of Supervisors, as well as union negotiations, compensation setting, all of those labor-related items, some of which, you know, will come into the purview of Measure K as we talk about how Measure K funds are going to be used. Ultimately, it is the board that handles and oversees all of the union negotiations and approving those different labor agreements. And then finally, you know, related to Measure K, obviously they appoint you all to this board. So that is they obviously have a lot more going on in their world with regard to running the county and overseeing at a policy level really all the activities of the county. But with respect to Measure K, those are kind of the big bullet points to be thinking about. Your committee is really aiding in public oversight and transparency for Measure K, for revenues and compliance with the underlying voter-approved ordinance. So your primary role is really to fill that need for transparency and public accountability, to make sure that what this money is being spent on fits within the ordinance that the voters adopted. You will be reviewing budgeted expenditures, so we will be talking about different proposed uses of Measure K funds and the revenues in total that will be generated for use under Measure K. And then your board will review actual spending reports of Measure K dollars. And so that could be an audit from the Auditor Controller's Office or interim financial reporting from our County Administrative Office. But your board will be reviewing the actual expenditures, not just the budgeted or planned expenditures. And then finally, your board will provide advice to the County Administrative Office and our Board of Supervisors regarding the use of these funds in the unincorporated areas. So those are kind of the high level points under the Citizens Oversight Committee. And unlike the Board of Supervisors, your committee really only has purview over the Measure K activities of Kern County. So we're not going to be talking about the other $3.6 billion that the county budget consists of and how that's used in all these different departments. It is just going to be Measure K. So the County Administrative Office, which I'm a part of, and I will be at your meetings, as is Mr. Weeb over here. He's going to be supporting, and some of our other staff. In fact, everyone you see in the audience is from our County Administrative Office and fills different roles that will interact at some level with your committee. So what we do in this regard, we oversee from a county-wide standpoint a lot of different activities in Kern County as the County Administrative Office, from policy recommendations to budget and financial controls. But as it regards to this particular Measure K committee, we will be doing the budget development and budget recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. So at the end of the day, the County Administrative Office is the branch that oversees the countywide development and management of the county budget. The same will be true for Measure K. So we'll be the ones doing the revenue projections and packaging up proposals for your board and for the Board of Supervisors ultimately to adopt. We will act as liaisons for really all the Measure K activities between different departments and your committee. So you'll hear different programs and projects that will be proposed from different departments of the county. We have a number of different departments in Kern County, and so there may be times when those departments come and make a presentation to your board to talk about the things that they'd like to do or how it would impact the community. But we will be the ones acting as liaisons between your board and them. So that won't be necessary all the time. There'll be times where it's pretty straightforward and we'll just bring forth that item, but there'll be times where we need to gather information and bring folks to you. So we'll act as those liaisons. We will function in the budget management and compliance area, and we do that countywide now. So once the Board of Supervisors adopts a budget for the county or for Measure K, the County Administrative Office, and we have a number of different analysts, some of which are here tonight, they actually work with the departments to make sure that the departments are operating within those approved budgets and that they're not using those funds for anything else, that they're using it for what they're supposed to do, and to help facilitate them to be effective in delivering the programs and services that they are with that budget. So we act as both a compliance mechanism to ensure that there's oversight and compliance, as well as helping them through kind of the regulatory process in getting things done, whether that's a procurement question or getting budget transfers accomplished or anything of that regards. With respect to Measure K, we will be the ones producing transparency documents. So there is a Measure K website that's been established. If you haven't been there, I'd encourage you to go there. If you go to kerncounty.com, there's a number of green circles, right on kind of the homepage. One of those green circles says Measure K. If you go there, we're putting everything Measure K related on that site. So agendas will be there for the public to view. Any agenda materials will be there, schedules. The underlying ordinance and resolution will be there. Your bylaws will be there. All Measure K related items will be there. There's a transparency tab. And it's nothing's on it yet because we haven't done anything yet. But in there, we'll have links to any of the budget reports, any financial reports that come before your board will go there for public disclosure, as well as we're going to be using some tools to visualize some of the outcomes. So not just what are we spending, but what are we accomplishing as far as the goals and objectives of how this money is being used. So we use a tool primarily called Power BI. It's a Microsoft tool to kind of visualize data. We have used that in a number of different cases to enhance transparency in other areas. That's going to be one of the tools we use here. So it won't just be spreadsheets and financial documents. We'll actually have some maybe information that's easier for the public to consume, and that'll be on there as well. And it won't just be financial reporting, but it'll also be outcome-based reporting. So what are we actually accomplishing here? So our office will be preparing those items. And then providing other relevant information to your committee and to the board relating to Measure K. It is the county administrative office that will be doing that work and bringing other items to you as needed. The county auditor controller has a role under Measure K. So that is an independently elected position, Kern County Auditor Controller. That's Ms. Amy Espinoza fills that role currently. And she and her office will be responsible for an annual report on Measure K revenues and expenditures that, this is according to the ordinance, goes to the Board of Supervisors and to the public. That will also come before your board. In fact, before we make it public, it will come here as part of an agenda package. But she is independent. She doesn't fall under the county administrative office, independently elected, though not really under the Board of Supervisors either. So that is the independent financial audit that she'll be providing on an or report on an annual basis. And then she also may, her office may, has purview to audit any revenues or expenditures under Measure K and prepare reports that would come before your board, the Board of Supervisors, and the public. So she's not obligated to do that, but has the purview, the authority to make any additional inquiries or audits and make those reports publicly available. So that will be her role, her office's role, rather. The Kern County, the clerk to the Board of Supervisors, so Ms. Kathy Krause before you is our clerk to the Board of Supervisors. Her office has a role in distributing meeting agendas, so it's the county administrative office, our office, that will be preparing those agendas. We'll be doing all of that work, but she's the office that will be distributing those. She'll be clerking our meetings, or someone from her office will be clerking our meetings and preparing meeting minutes. And those minutes will be posted on our transparency site. So that's kind of organizationally how we're going to function. And then Kern County Council, to my right here, they will be providing ongoing legal advice and support as needed going forward. So that's one of the items will be some training on today's, but typically it'll be handling legal questions that may arise as we have our meetings. I know today we're meeting, obviously, in the Board of Supervisors chambers. That may not always be the case. In fact, we have intentions to have some other space made available to meet on a more regular basis, just because this space gets used for other meetings as well. So we're exploring, or we're working on those plans right now. I would say for the next 6 months, I would expect to be meeting in these chambers. After that, I hope to have another space that's similar, has similar capabilities for us all to meet. It will always be here in downtown Bakersfield, so we'll keep you posted as to those developments. Now, with respect to, so that's kind of an overview of the main offices and boards that will be kind of overseeing the Measure K process. I want to touch a little bit at a pretty high level on just the county budget process, how that works, and how the Measure K process is going to work alongside that. So we are currently in process right now developing the 2023-2024 budget for all of Kern County. The way that starts is our office, the CAO, brings forth a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors to set what we call as a budget guideline. So it's kind of high-level parameters for budgets to be, for departments rather, to be able to craft their budgets and fit within. And so we did that, I think, back in February. The board adopted the guideline, and each department is now working on preparing those budgets. Ms. Elsa Martinez is our CFO. She's here in our audience today. She and her staff, some of which are here today, are the analysts that actually work with the departments, and they work with multiple departments to develop that budget. And then obviously they oversee that kind of compliance and monitoring function also. But she will be working with those departments and her staff as they prepare their budgets in accordance with that guideline that the Board of Supervisors set. The departments then formally submit their budgets to the CAO. So all of those budgets from our, 30 or 40 different departments all come into the CAO's office, and under the guidance of our CFO and her staff, all of those different budgets get compiled into a large countywide budget. And so that's, and that work is going on right now. In addition to that, we're working with a number of other departments to analyze our revenue streams, tax revenues primarily, sales tax, property tax from the county assessor's office, for example, understanding what property values are doing, and the CFO and her team are painting that picture, bringing all our revenues together and all those departmental budgets. We then have a series of public hearings with respect to the budget, so that's going to happen in around June. A budget then gets adopted by the Board of Supervisors, and I'm simplifying this process a little bit because it's very lengthy. Gets adopted. Once it's adopted by the board, we get it into our computer system, and our staff at the CAO's office then takes in that role of kind of compliance and monitoring and assisting those departments in managing those budgets going forward. So that is the general picture of how that budget happens. We have about an 8,000 employee workforce, and as I said before, about a $3.6 billion budget. A lot of that budget is federal and state funding that's legally restricted to deliver certain programs and services. Of that, we have about $400 million. That is what we call discretionary revenue. So it's local revenues that we put to use here to fund things like the Sheriff's Department primarily. They're a big recipient of that, but it's also parks, it's libraries, it's animal services. It's a lot of the local services that you'd expect in kind of local government, right? A lot of those things are what a city would do for their incorporated residents. A lot of that money goes to fund, not all of it, but a lot of it goes to fund those same types of services for our unincorporated residents. That's really where Measure K comes into play. We're not looking to supplant or support federal or state programs that folks like at DHS or Behavioral Health may be already delivering. We're looking at enhancing those local services that $400 million is going to now. Measure K is estimated to generate about $54 million a year. It started being collected April 1st. It gets collected at the state level and then remitted back to us at the end of the next quarter. So we haven't really seen any money yet, and it's hard for us to gauge exactly what that number is going to look like. So that'll feed into kind of our recommendations on how this money gets spent. Because it's a little hard to tell because we haven't actually gotten any yet. So we're still making estimates. But to give you a feeling, you know, if we're talking about $400 million in general discretionary revenue for our county, this is about $54 million. So it's about a 12% increase in that overall spending. And that's the piece that we're going to be focused on with your committee. So this process, the budget for the Measure K funds is going to work very similarly. We are developing those revenue estimates. As I mentioned, it's about $54 million currently. We'll be refining those estimates as we know more and we get a little more actual information behind us. We have developed a Measure K budget, kind of Measure K request form that we have distributed out to all of our departments. And specifically, it asks them to describe a new program or an enhanced program or project that department may think qualifies under Measure K and they'd like to request funding from. We ask if it's one time or ongoing because that's obviously something we need to watch pretty carefully. And where the location is. Some things may be specific to unincorporated communities. Some may be more broad as something that would impact all of our unincorporated communities. And then we're asking for measurable outcomes. And so this is, hey, what are you trying to accomplish with this funding, and how are we going to measure it? Because we're going to want to provide ongoing quarterly reporting as to not just the expenditures, but the outcomes of those projects as well. So that form is actually in circulation now. It's been sent out to all of our departments, and we've gotten a number of them back. I haven't seen them yet, so I'm looking forward to reviewing them. But our analysts under our CFO are gathering all those now and reviewing them to make sure they meet the basic criteria of Measure K before they move further along in the system. So departments submit those requests to the CAO's office. We're going to review all of those submittals. We're reviewing them, one, for compliance with the ordinance. That's pretty black and white. But then alignment with our community survey priorities. So what led up to Measure K were two different surveys plus some ongoing survey work to hear from our community what was important to them and where they felt, you know, where they felt they wanted more services and what those priorities were. So we have that data, and we're going to be using that to inform kind of how we move forward, especially in this first year of implementation. So alignment with those community service priorities, we're going to be looking for alignment with the priorities of the Board of Supervisors and our five-year strategic plan. So how does this not only align with what we've heard from community members specifically, but with what we know our board has set out as their priorities and our five-year strategic plan? We're going to be looking to balance kind of one-time projects and ongoing expenditures so that we know how much we're committing on an ongoing basis versus what are one-time projects that we're just allocating funds to get done on that basis. And then we'll be looking to kind of, I wouldn't say rank these, but we have to prioritize them. You know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't hear someone say, oh, I've got an idea for Measure K, or a department saying, hey, I've got plans, or we can use Measure K for that. So I'm sure that we have a lot more requests from our departments coming in than we have money. So we have to prioritize those before we can bring them back to your board. The CAO's office, we will present to your Citizens Oversight Committee a package of Measure K proposals for compliance review and for advice. So we're going to be doing all that work, gathering all that information, and it's going to be a back and forth with our department heads as we kind of refine what it is exactly they want to do, I'm sure. We'll package up a proposal of all of those, bring that forth to your committee in order to review and discuss and get advice. Again, both for compliance and for advice. Ultimately, we will then take a package of those proposals in the form of a budget to the Board of Supervisors with a recommendation for approval. And the board at some point, you know, based on their feedback, they'll adopt a Measure K budget. So we will adopt both a normal county budget that the board is doing now under that process I already talked about. They will also ultimately adopt a Measure K budget. That way we can separately show the Measure K budget to the public on our website. It's very clear. And then we'll obviously combine them both in our system so that we can implement and monitor and carry out those activities. So the CAO will present the board the Measure K budget. They will ultimately adopt it. Then we get into the ongoing compliance and reporting. It's really a function, again, of the CAO's office and the Auditor Controller's office. We'll both be doing work there. We'll be updating our transparency website. We'll be doing annual fiscal reports. We'll be doing interim fiscal reports as we meet with your board. We will have audits from the Kern County Auditor Controller on an annual basis, and then any other reporting that may come up. So that's the general cycle of what to expect over this next 9 months as we move through this process. We will be meeting with your board in June. So we're busy right now gathering those Measure K proposals. Our next meeting, I believe, is already scheduled, and we will have a package before you to start talking about actual projects and proposals and what we're recommending at the CAO for funding under Measure K. I would anticipate 3 to 4 meetings a year of your committee, and it really depends on the needs that may come up, but you know, I can see just the act of getting the budget together, and then when we have an audit report to review, that's 2 meetings right there. And I can definitely see the need for another meeting or 2, depending on how revenues are coming in under Measure K. Maybe we have more, maybe we have less, and how to adjust accordingly. We may also have some reporting and transparency things we want to share with you. So I would anticipate 3 to 4 meetings. So that's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions from your committee, if there are any.
I have one. Can you share the 5-year strategic plan with us, or is it this high
wide? That's a great question. We intentionally made it not this high and this wide. It's very simple. It fits on one page. It's on our website. We will send it to you. I'll have it emailed out to all of you committee members so you can see that. I think we did that last year, if I remember correctly, but the time flies. So happy to share that with you.
That was one of the same questions I had. My other one is, can we see the form that they're using right now to make a recommendation?
I will send you a copy of the form as well as the 5-year strategic plan.
Regina?
Jeffrey?
No? Laura? No?
Yes. Is the criteria also on the form, or is that on your end only?
The criteria...
Let's say I have an idea, right? But not me as in this seat, mm-hmm. but, you know, somebody from one of the departments. And they are able to see on the form, this is a criteria, and they automatically see, okay, that's not a good idea, not even bother filling out the form, versus filling out the form, and then it gets to you, and their bubble gets bursted, if that makes sense. So does it kind of give them a heads up, this is what we're looking for?
So we have specifically included on the form that, so Measure K is a general tax measure.
Right.
Right? So it can legally be spent on anything the county does. But the ordinance itself was written to include specific language in the ballot title that highlighted the community priorities that we heard back from community members. So when you see the form, it'll actually have a drop-down box that lists all of those specific items that were included in the ballot title and language, but then it says other. And so departments could say other, and then they describe to us what it is that they're doing. They may have a good idea. We don't want to not hear from them. We want to hear from them. But we also are very keen about sticking close to those things that the public told us was important to them, and Measure K were included on that. So we have communicated those priorities that really reflect the community's input to us. But also that we're open to other options as well.
That was my concern, the other part. If it was only specific to something, and like you said, it could be a good idea.
Yep.
So. One other question. Is the community able to still propose things themselves that did not get included? So I'm not sure if I missed that, but it sounds like this form is more internal. Is there anything that's external?
So, no, it's not external. It is internal. We always take feedback from community members, and so my contact information's on the site, and people can feel free to reach out to me and send me ideas that they may have. I plan to do another round of community survey work probably later next year, so we'll be re-polling people also to kind of get a consensus of the community's, broader community's sentiment too on needs, but if someone approaches you and says, hey, I've got a great idea, have them connect them to me. We'll get that information. We'll try to connect them to the right department that provides that type of service. You know, if it's something to do with libraries, they need to make sure they coordinate with the librarian, right? So
or parks.
Yeah, or park, exactly, or okay. Parks. So. We're happy to take community input, yeah.
I can see it. I can see it coming up more on the other box.
Yes.
That's where I'm concerned about.
Yeah.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Kendra.
Okay. You ready?
Now we're going to County Council?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, good evening. I'm Kendra Graham, for those I didn't get a chance to meet, and I'm the Assistant County Counsel. I've been asked to go over some of the laws that are applicable to you, and what I did is I just kind of briefly want to just touch on a few things that are mentioned in the bylaws. So I'll start with the bylaws, Article 3, Section 3. This states that you will follow the Roberts Rules of Order when not in conflict with the committee's bylaws or state laws, including the Ralph M. Brown Act. So I just wanted to point out that there may be times when the two do conflict. I don't see it very often, but I have seen it conflict where, say, you might be hearing a lot of public comment and time is really passing by and you're hearing too much. And I've heard people say, well, I want to call the question. And in essence, they're calling for a vote at that time. In that situation, if it would cut off public comment, we can't do it because it would conflict with the Brown Act. So there might be other times. That's the only one I've really seen, but there could be others that occur. And so I just wanted to point that out, that yes, you can follow Robert's Rules of Orders, but if it conflicts with the Brown Act, then we can't do that. So that's one. Second, I want to point to Article 3, Section 6 of your bylaws, and as well as Article 4, Section 2, that state that you are subject to the Brown Act and you must receive Brown Act training prior to your first regular meeting. So you will notice that on your agenda, this is not your first regular meeting. It's a special meeting for training purposes so that we can get this Brown Act training in ahead of time. Article 3, Section 7 and Article 4, Section 1 state that committee meeting agendas, minutes, reports are a matter of public record and shall be posted on the county's website. Also, that materials provided to the committee are public record and will be provided in accordance with the Public Records Act. So the California Public Records Act provides that various records of the county, including its boards, commissions, committees, and its members, staff, and employees, are subject to public disclosure if it pertains to the people's business. And specifically, the law states that access to information concerning the conduct of the people's business is a fundamental and necessary right of every person in this state. So there are various exceptions that allow withholding of certain confidential or private personal information. So I just wanted to point out that it's not just our agendas, minutes, reports, or documents that are provided to your committee that are subject to public disclosure, but it could also include your personal email, or not your personal emails, but emails or text messages on your personal devices if they are about the people's business or the business of this committee. So we do not actually search your phones or your personal phones or your personal computers, but we do expect you to search it in compliance with a public records request or a subpoena if it would come through. So I just wanted to advise you to be mindful of that when you're texting each other, because we do receive a lot of public records requests nowadays, and people are getting savvy to saying, I want to see your text messages and your emails on your personal devices, and it gets very complicated. So just be mindful of that. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that our office, we're here to help you through that process. We don't want to disclose your personal stuff, so we're going to redact anything that's of a personal nature or confidential nature and not provide it and fight to keep those things confidential. However, if it's subject to disclosure, we do have to disclose it. Next, I want to touch on the bylaws of Article 4, Section 2 that requires AB 1234 ethics training. The online information provides that this training is provided by Kern County Council's office. I'm not providing that training today, nor am I the one that normally provides it for our office, but we can certainly schedule that if anyone needs it. I understand that most of you have it already. You have to have it once every 2 years. So if you've already had it and you have your certificate, or you've submitted your certificate to the county, you do not need to do it again. But if you need it, we can certainly schedule something with our office, or you can do that training through the FPPC's website. It's easy to get to. You can almost just Google FPPC, you know, ethics training, and it pops up. Then there's a link for state training and one for a local official training. Make sure you click the local official training. And then you will have to read, for those that already have it and do not need to set through another training, just make sure you do it again within your 2 years and you're good. So the last thing I want to touch on is Section 4, Article 4, Section 3, that requires your FPPC Form 700 statement of economic interest to be filed, and you have to do that once you assume office annually, and then also upon leaving office. And you have to actually do those forms for every committee you're on. So if you've already done an FPPC 700, you will have to do another one for this committee. I do understand, and I looked it up today, they now have a new electronic filing system, so if you qualify to use the electronic filing system, you can get a passcode through the FPPC and do it through there, and you don't have to submit it to Kathy. I don't know if you would qualify or not, but if you do, you can certainly do that. And my understanding, it's so easy to use because it keeps track of all the ones you've done before, so you can cut and paste from it, and it can file all of them for all the different committees and boards that you're on. So that's all I have for legal updates, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Thank you, Kendra.
You're welcome. And now, are you ready to move into the Brown Act training? Uh-huh. Okay. So the next item is the Brown Act training. So you have a packet in front of you so you can take notes. I don't want to panic any of you. It's like 91 slides. I'm going to speed through it quickly, as quickly as I possibly can. It's usually about an hour. As I get close to that 1 hour, I'll mark my watch here. I will start speeding through them so that we can get out of here in an hour. But I did want to include more, so that's why it's so long, because this is a good reference tool for you to use if you ever need to. You will see that throughout the slides, I make reference to the government code sections at the bottom of each slide, so you can always go pull the statute if you need to do that as well. Let's see. So Government Code Section 54950 sets forth the Brown Act. You all also, in addition to the PowerPoint that you have, you also have a right to a copy of the full code. So if you want it, let me know. I will print it out and get it to you. So this is Mr. Brown. I thought you might want to put a face with a name. This was taken in 1959. And then the last thing I recall, I was sitting in a Brown Act training. I must have died from boredom. So this is some dry stuff, and I am so sorry to make you sit through this for an hour. So bear with me here. So the intent of the Brown Act is, in enacting this chapter, the legislature finds and declares that public commissions, boards, and councils, and the other public agencies in this state exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. And is the intent of the law that their actions be taken openly and that their deliberations be conducted openly, and that the people of the state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them, that in delegating authority they do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. So the Brown Act is also known as the Open Meetings Law, and that's pretty much the gist of all of this training, is that this is an open meeting, the public can come, and then what are the requirements for these open meetings that we have, and so that we give proper notice to the public so that they can come and attend and be heard and hear what you are discussing. So how is it achieved? All meetings of the legislative body of a local agency, which is the County of Kern, shall be open in public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of a legislative body, except as otherwise provided. And the otherwise provided is closed session. And somewhere as we move through these slides, we'll get to a closed session portion. I don't anticipate you really ever having a closed session meeting, so we'll speed through that quickly, but that's what it means by as otherwise provided. So a local agency would be a county, a city, you know, subdivisions, things of that nature. So we are a local agency, the County of Kern. So how to determine if a Brown Act actually applies to a particular local agency meeting? Is if the board or commission or committee of the local agency meets the definition of a legislative body, then the Brown Act applies. So not all committees are considered legislative bodies. The first way we get there is if it's a governing body that is created by state or federal statute, like the Board of Supervisors or the City Council's office, then it's obviously going to be subject to the Brown Act. Then we have a commission, committee, board, or other body of local agency, whether it's temporary, decision-making, or advisory, created by charter, ordinance, or resolution, or some other formal action of a legislative body. This is you. This is your committee. This is the one you fall under and why you're subject to the Brown Act. So you were created by a formal action of our Board of Supervisors, and that was done through Kern County Ordinance number A375. It created Chapter 4.18, which is the unincorporated Kern County Public Safety Vital Services Local Control Measure. And then we also, let me back up here. Section 4.18.200 provides that we will create the Citizens Oversight Committee, and that's what we did through a resolution, and that resolution number is there, and you should have a copy of that or have access to it. So that's how you became subject to the Brown Act, was through that code section. There are some exceptions to the code section, and one is an ad hoc committee. I don't know that if you will ever have an ad hoc committee in this committee, but it's possible, and that could be if you want to look into something and you want to create a subcommittee, and it would have to be less than a quorum of your members, and they could, let's say you chose two members, and then they went and met with some community members as well, and then they are going to report back to your board. And if it's for like a limited purpose, usually it's a limited duration of time as well, that would be an ad hoc committee. They are not subject to the Brown Act. However, you have to be careful with ad hoc committees, because if you continue to use them for different purposes at different times, and you say, oh, well, we need another, you know, ad hoc committee, let's just use the one that we used before, and you keep doing that for different purposes, pretty soon you run the risk of them becoming a standing committee. Standing committees are subject to the Brown Act. So that's just something to be aware of. So let's see, another way that you can become subject to the Brown Act is private corporations or nonprofits can be subject to the Brown Act. Their boards can be subject to the Brown Act, if under two circumstances. This obviously doesn't apply to you, but I wanted you to be aware of it. And that's if it's created by an elected legislative body in order to exercise authority that the legislative authority can delegate to this other board. And if that board they're delegating to happens to be a nonprofit or another corporation, they may be subject to the Brown Act. Or if they provide funds to that other agency and they have someone on their governing body who is a voting member, that also makes that private agency subject to the Brown Act. Even if the voting member eventually moves on to a non-voting position, they're still locked in as a Brown Act board. So let's move on to meetings. So what is a meeting? It's any congregation of a majority of the members of a legislative body at the same time and location, including teleconference location, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. So here, for your committee, we have three members. So we have a picture here with three members on it. So if Ms. Barbage, Ms. Houchin, and Mr. Commode decide to get together at lunchtime and discuss business of the county, you've created a meeting of your board, and it's going to be subject to the Brown Act. So if you did not agendize that meeting and invite the public to that meeting, you have a violation of the Brown Act. If it's just Ms. Barbage and Ms. Houchin, you're going to be fine. But once you add that third person, that's where we have a problem. One thing to be careful of, and maybe not so much for this committee, but maybe, at the end of your terms, if somebody new is appointed in your position, but you're still sitting because the date hasn't become effective yet, and so two of you decide to take that elected person coming in to lunch and discuss what you do and how you do it and some of the issues that have arose, you could have a Brown Act violation, because they are, once they're elected, even if they haven't taken seat yet, they're treated for the same they're treated as though they are a member. So it would count towards a quorum, because it takes three to make a quorum of your board. This has actually happened once before at a meeting, and it was we had to stop the meeting because we had a Brown Act violation. It needed to be agendized as a meeting of the Board of Supervisors, because there were two sitting members and one incoming member that were at the same meeting. So it's been a long time. So another thing to be aware of are serial meetings, A serial meeting is a majority is when a majority of the members of a legislative body, or let me rephrase that, a majority shall not use a series of communications of any kind, directly or through intermediaries, to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of their committee. So in the first diagram there, I show this is like a 12, let's say this is a 12-member board, and one person talks to three. We don't have a problem, right, because it's not a majority of the board. But when those three members then go talk to other members, and pretty, it's kind of like a game of telephone where you're just passing the buck and saying, this is what they said. Now you have what's called a serial meeting. You're using an intermediary so that you can all come to a consensus, and that would be a Brown Act violation. Likewise, in the next diagram, we call this the hub and spoke type situation, where one person talks to one member, figures out what they want to, you know, come to a consensus on, then goes and talks to another person and tells them what the first person says, and so on and so on, until pretty soon everyone knows what everyone's thinking and you have a consensus. So that would be a violation of the Brown Act as well. I forgot to tell you that if you have questions as we go, you know, please let me know. The best way to train sometimes is if you have questions, just ask during the middle of the presentation. You don't need to wait until the end. And so I'm going to ask you a few questions as well. You can just nod. You don't have to speak, but you're welcome to. So can an employee or official of a local agency, let's say our CAO or Mr. Zervis here, can they meet with each of you separately to inform or answer questions about a matter within the subject matter jurisdiction of the local, of your committee? What do you think? Yes, absolutely he can do that. But what he can't do is he can't then take what each of you say and take it to the other person. Then we have that hub and spoke type of situation. But yes, he can meet with each of you and you can discuss things. Can a member of the legislative body engage in conversations with the public on social media about a matter that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body? What do you think? This is a fairly new one, just like in the last few years. And what it says is, yes, the member can have conversations or communications on an internet-based social media platform. They can answer questions, provide information to the public, or solicit information from the public regarding a matter that's within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body, provided that a majority of the members do not use that same platform to discuss amongst themselves business that's within your jurisdiction. And that also goes for using emojis or thumbs up, you know, angry faces to show your like or dislike for something, because then you start to form a consensus again. So what about, can a majority of the members of a legislative body attend a conference or publicized meeting or notice meeting of another body or similar gathering open to the public that involves a discussion or issues of general interest to the public? What do you think? Yes. As long as a majority of the members do not discuss amongst themselves, other than as part of the scheduled program, business of a specific nature that's within the subject matter jurisdiction. What we normally like to tell people is, if you go to these types of events, don't congregate together, separate, so that there's, you know, people always like to say, ooh, gotcha. I caught some of my public officials meeting and discussing things, and there's a violation of the Brown Act. So just for appearance sake, you know, don't congregate if you can. I think it's on a different slide. Can a majority of the members of a legislative body attend purely social or ceremonial occasions, such as a retirement party or a funeral? And the answer is the same. Yes, as long as, again, they're not discussing business together. And it's the same rule, try to separate. But I have been to funerals where they set all the board members together. You know, clearly they're not discussing business during a funeral setting. So it's okay. But if you have the opportunity to separate, separate. If it's assigned seating and they put you all together, that's fine. Can a majority of the members of a legislative body attend an open and notice meeting of a standing committee of that body? So Remember, we talked about creating ad hoc committees and standing committees. So if you have a standing committee that's subject to the Brown Act, can you attend, a majority of you attend that meeting because you've got, let's say you've got two on there already, and now you show up and that makes a quorum. Can you do that? Can you go to that meeting? The answer is yes, as long as members of the legislative body who are not members of the standing committee attend only as observers. So you can't speak, you can't talk at that committee meeting. Okay. Can a member of a legislative body attend a notice meeting of a legislative body remotely? And that means by teleconference or video conference. The answer is yes. And if they can, does that such member's attendance count towards establishing a quorum? Again, the answer is yes. And if so, can that member attend via teleconference or cell phone from his or her vehicle while traveling? No. The answer is no on that because... Right, that's correct. So this is the general rule on remote meetings and teleconferencing. It's like you can do that provided that the agenda for the meeting shall be posted at all teleconference locations. So wherever you're going to be, there has to be a posted agenda. And each teleconference location has to be identified in the notice and agenda, and each teleconference location has to be accessible to the public. And all votes taken shall be by roll call. So if you decide to attend remotely under this general rule from your home, you have to open your home up to the public. And that's really difficult to do if you're traveling in the car. We can't pinpoint. I suppose a clever person could figure out a way to make it happen and says, at this date and time, I'm going to be at the McDonald's on Highway 99 or whatever the case may be. But for the most part, no, it's got to be an agendized place. And they do count towards the quorum, provided that at least a quorum of the members shall participate from locations within the jurisdictional boundaries. There's an exception for health authorities. And no, they can't travel. I mean, they can't use their vehicle as a location. So there is an exception to this. That is the general rule. There is an exception. I'm not going to walk through the exception, but what I've done is I've taken the exception and I've kind of just copied the whole statute in here. It takes up several slides. I don't see us using this. The county has pretty much gone to in-person meetings. But in the event that there is a true emergency and you have to do business, we do have this exception available. The emergency exception, we were doing it during the pandemic. That's how it was created. In beginning of January 2023, it was revised, effective January 1st. And it made it a little more difficult, especially for us as the county to comply. It doesn't really work with the technology that we have. There's so many requirements and things that you have to put in place in order to make this work that I don't see it happening. But it's available in case, you know, push comes to shove. This emergency exception will end, though, on January 1st, 2024. But also on January 1st, 2024, I'm going to skip through the emergency exception, but there it all is. So it ends in January 1st, 2024. At the same time they created this new emergency exception, they also created, I'm just going to call it the new exception. And in this one, it's going to be in effect until January 1st, 2026. Similar to the emergency exception, it really is going to be difficult for our county to comply with, so we prefer in-person meetings. But it is an option. It's there. It requires the person requesting to attend remotely. And I guess what I should say is that remote requirement, what it means is you don't have to open it up for the public to come to wherever you are. You could be homesick and attending, or with a sick child and attending, and you don't have to open your location up to the public. But there are real specific requirements on this, too. We have to have audio-visual that's two-way. And if something goes wrong with the audio-visual, we have to stop the meeting until it's fixed. And whoever is requesting it, they can do, like, a general request. I think it's called for good cause, just cause. And they can only do that twice within a calendar year for just cause. But then they have another exception for an emergency cause. and that could be their sick or their child's sick. It's really just, I think, an extension of the pandemic to kind of wean people off remote meetings, because it is going to end as well, unless new legislation comes up in the meantime that replaces it. But as far as I can tell at this point, as of January 1st, 2026, we're all back to that general rule, which is posting at the locations and inviting people in. The other thing about this new exception is it has to be approved by your board. So if somebody requests due to just cause or an emergency, it has to go to the board for approval before that. And if your board says no, then they can't attend remote. So I'm going to skip through these. Let's go to time, place, and manner of the meetings. So legislative bodies of local agencies shall provide by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or by whatever rule is required for the conduct of the business of that body, the time, place, and holding of regular meetings. You, however, fall under the next part that says, however, meetings of advisory committees or standing committees for which an agenda is posted at least 72 hours in advance of the meeting shall be considered regular meetings. So you, by resolution or ordinance, do not have set times and dates of your meetings going forward. You will set them as needed throughout the year. And that's because you're an advisory committee and you can do that. So regular and special meetings must be held within the boundaries of the territory over which the local agency exercises jurisdiction. So you don't need to be here in this room, but you have to be somewhere in Kern County. And then there's a few exceptions, which, again, I don't see ever happening. And if they do, well, God help us all. If there was an emergency and there was no physical location we can hold it, let's say there was an earthquake that destroyed the buildings, you could do it outside of Kern County. So there's exceptions like that, and I won't walk through each of them because most of them are not going to apply to your board. But if you ever want to look at them, here they are, and you can look at the code section. Lots of exceptions. If you're ever sued, which I don't see that happening either, you could all go to the federal court or wherever it is in another county, and there you would all be there as a quorum, which would technically be a meeting, and that would be okay as well. Here's the one I was talking about. If you end up having to meet in another location due to a fire or flood or earthquake, I guess flood might be a possibility in the coming future, as we've heard. We hope not. The notice must be provided to local media that have requested notice by the most rapid means of communication available. Special meetings. So special meetings, again, I don't really see that you guys calling a special meeting, but you might if you have a general meeting and then you want to have another meeting and you don't have time for 72-hour notification, you could call a sooner meeting by special meeting, but you also might just do an adjourned meeting, which would also suffice. So special meetings can be called by the chairman or by a majority of the members. Written notice must be delivered to each member and to each local media requesting notice in writing and posting a notice of the local on the local agency's internet webpage. And Ms. Krause will take care of that for you. The notice will be delivered and received at least 24 hours before the time of the meeting, and it shall specify the time, place, and business to be discussed. This doesn't apply to you, but I bolded it because you may not, special meetings cannot be held to discuss salaries or salary schedules or compensation. And no other business can be considered except for what's on the agenda. Must be posted 24 hours prior to the special meeting at a location freely accessible to members and the public. Then we have emergency meetings, and that is as determined by a majority of the members of the board or committee. It could be for work stoppage or crippling activity or other activity that severely impairs public health, safety, or both. And then they have a further emergency, which is if you picture emergency, then you picture a dire emergency that does not require any notification other than as soon as you can. Okay. Media requesting notice of special meetings shall be notified by the chairman or designee 1 hour before the meeting in these emergency situations. And again, if dire, as soon as possible. Notice can be shall be by phone, and if there's no phone service, prior notice is waived, but shall be given as soon as soon after the meeting as possible. I'm going to skip through this. Going over to agendas now. Check my time. Okay, so the content. They must contain the content of your agendas, they must contain a brief description of each item of business to be transacted or discussed at the meeting, including items to be discussed in closed session. And any description does not need to exceed 20 words. They must specify a time and location of the meeting. Must include information regarding how, to whom, and when a request for disability-related modification or accommodation may be made. And they must provide opportunity for the public to address the legislative body on any matter within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body and on any agendized item, either before or during consideration of the item. So this would be your public comment periods. The public can respond on any item on the agenda. Then we also give a general public comment so that they can discuss any matter that maybe is not on the agenda, but it still falls within your subject matter jurisdiction. No action or discussions shall be taken on any item not appearing on the posted agenda. There are exceptions to that we can get to here in a minute, but however, members of a legislative body or its staff may briefly respond to statements made or questions posed. Ask questions for clarification, make a brief announcement, make a brief report on his or her own activities, make a referral to staff, or take action to direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. We actually have this statement posted on your agendas, so during the public comment, if you ever need to cite from that, it's always right here. It comes up from time to time, so we try to make that easy for you. Non-agendized items. This is when I said that there are some exceptions. A legislative body may take action on non-agendized items only under certain circumstances, and that's upon a determination by a majority vote that emergency situation exists, and upon a determination by a two-thirds vote of the members present, or if less than two-thirds members are present, a unanimous vote, that there is a need to take immediate action and that need for action came to the attention of the local agency after the agenda was posted. And then there's just some steps you have to walk through in order to make those determinations on the record. There's a form. There's a form that we provide to Ms. Krause, and then she reads it into the record. I don't suspect you'll probably need that, but it's there just in case. Posting requirements, again, just a recap, 72 hours before a meeting, special meetings, 24 hours, emergency meetings, 1 hour before the meeting, to media requesting such notice. So it must be posted in a location that is freely accessible to members of the public and on the local agency's internet website, if the local agency has one. It must be made available in appropriate alternative formats to persons with a disability. And as of January 1st, 2019, so we've been doing this for a while now, there was a new rule for internet posting that must be a direct link, must be searchable, must be downloadable, and then there are some exceptions that apply to that. Mail notice, any person who wants a copy of a mail notice of your agenda can request it. If they do request, it must be made available in appropriate alternative formats for those with disabilities. It must be mailed at time the agenda is posted or upon distribution to a majority of the members of the legislative body. And they can review their requests for these mail notices every year. And we can charge them for copies. And we can also provide it to them by email if they ask that it be emailed to them. So now we get into the proceedings of the meeting, so the public attendance. A member of the public shall not be required as a condition to attendance at a meeting of a legislative body to register his or her name. to provide their other information, to complete a questionnaire, or otherwise to fulfill any condition precedent to their attendance. They could come and not provide you their name, and you know, if you ask them for their name, they can say, I'm not going to give it to you, and there's nothing that you can do about it. They're entitled to attend. All sign-in sheets, if we have them, shall clearly state that signing is voluntary and not a requirement. Any member of the public attending an open and public meeting may record the proceeding or take photographs at the proceeding, unless the legislative body makes a finding that such recording cannot continue without noise, illumination, or obstruction of view, constituting a persistent disruption to the proceedings. I've not seen that happen, but I suppose it could if they brought in some loud piece of machinery. Public recordings by the local agency are subject to the public records. And so when you see CEPR, that's the California Public Records request. Time limitations. The legislative body may limit the total amount of time allocated for public testimony on particular issues and for individual speakers. Clearly, you don't need to do that here today, and I don't know, in future meetings, depending on the amount of public that comes, you might be advised to go ahead and set some time limits. But you don't have to, but you know, depending on how things go throughout these meetings. When public testimony is limited, the legislative body must allot twice the amount of time to someone who utilizes a translator, unless they have a device that utilizes simultaneous translation equipment. So that's just something to keep in mind. So then I put this in here just to kind of lighten it up a little bit. Could we extend the annual meeting? I still have a lot of complaining to do. The answer is no. Public criticism. The legislative body of a local agency shall not prohibit public criticism of the policies, procedures, programs, or services of the agency, or the acts or omissions of the legislative body. So people have the right to freedom of speech. They can come in and they can criticize us, and we have to take it and listen to it. However, nothing in this law says that they have any additional privileges than what the law provides. And what that really means is if they are not engaging in protected speech, we can shut it down. So that would be things that are considered fighting words, or using extremely foul language or something of that nature, you can shut them down. So such language would not be protected under the freedom of speech. Disorderly conduct is another area. In the event a meeting is so willfully interrupted by a group or groups of persons that it renders the orderly conduct of such meeting unfeasible, and order cannot be restored by the removal of those individuals who are willfully interrupting the meeting, your body can order the meeting room cleared and continue in session. Only matters appearing on the agenda may be considered in such a situation. And representatives of the media, except those participating in the disturbance, shall be allowed to remain at the meeting. A legislative body may stop a speaker who becomes overly repetitious, whose subject is irrelevant to the board's subject matter jurisdiction, or the speaker loses all sense of decorum and becomes disruptive. You can also have them removed. So moving on to actions taken, no action by secret ballot. And that's why we have Ms. Krause take roll call votes. Legislative body must publicly report any action taken and the vote or abstention on that action of each member present for the action. Adjournment. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. I really hate the wording of the statute. It's, you know, the legislative body of a local agency may adjourn any regular, adjourned regular, special, or adjourned special meeting to a time and place specified in the order of adjournment. Basically, when you finish a meeting, you adjourn to another meeting, and that's what that's talking about. And if you show up for a meeting and there's less than a quorum, you can adjourn to another date. Let me skip through this a little bit. Continuance. Hearings can be continued in the same manner and same extent as adjournments. So if you're in the middle of a hearing, you can continue that hearing. And what that means is you can continue it. And in some circumstances, depending on when that the continuance or that adjournment is, you might have to re-agendize it. But if it's within a certain amount of time, you may not have to re-agendize. You're just continuing it. Less than 24 hours is the time period specified. Oh, that's saying that you have to post it within 24 hours. Sorry. So closed sessions, again, I told you I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on these, but I wanted to include them just so that you had them. They're closed session exceptions. Let me go back to that first slide there. So this one says, no closed session may be held by any legislative body of a local agency except as expressly authorized by the Act. And here is the Act provisions that allow for closed session. And again, I don't suspect any of these will come up, but they're there. In case you ever have a need, you can look at it and say, ooh, do we meet any of these exceptions? And then you can always ask my office and we'll walk you through it as well. So I'm going to slide through these quickly. I want to get you out of here. There's a section. If you do have a closed session, you have to report out on certain items. And I'm not there yet, sorry. This is the sample descriptions for closed session. They call these safe harbor descriptions, and this is what we usually use on our County Board of Supervisors agendas. So here's the next slide. Prior to closed session, the legislative body shall disclose in open meeting all items to be discussed in closed session. You cannot consider a matter not on the agenda. And after closed session, they may reconvene in open session and make required disclosures of actions taken. And the board has a right to address the public has a right to address the board on any items that are on closed session. They can't be in closed session, but during open session, they can address those items. Here's the public report out I was talking about that I jumped the gun on. Upon approval of the I'm not going to go through all these, but these are all the areas that have to be reported out. And so if you ever had a closed session, this is just a little bullet-pointed list of things that have to be reported out. They must be oral or written, the report out, and upon request of a person within 24 hours of posting of an agenda, they may receive copies of any contracts, settlements, agreements, or other documents that were finally approved in closed session. A person may not disclose confidential information that's been acquired by being present in a closed session meeting unless the body authorizes disclosure. And there are, of course, exceptions for reporting violations to the district attorney or whistleblowing. Penalties for violating the Brown Act, it's a misdemeanor. Costs and attorney's fees are awarded to the plaintiff. It may also be awarded to the defendant if the action is clearly frivolous and totally lacking in merit. So penalties for releasing closed session information, which again you shouldn't have to worry about, but it could be injunctive relief to prevent disclosure of the information. Disciplinary action if you happen to be an employee, and a referral to the grand jury is another option. And then there's ways to stop or prevent violations of the Brown Act. And there's a whole process for this, but in essence, the district attorney or any interested person may seek a court order requiring that closed sessions be recorded. And they may also seek injunctive or declaratory relief. And then there's a procedure for people to, you know, for them to listen to the recordings of closed session. The district attorney or any interested person may commence an action by mandamus or injunction for the purpose of obtaining a judicial determination that an action taken by a legislative body is in violation of the act and therefore null and void. Because that's usually the remedy, that whatever you did in violation of the Brown Act is null and void. The legislative body may, once you get notice that you violated the Brown Act, you have an opportunity to go back and cure it by bringing the matter back before you and doing it properly. If it's a past unlawful action, the district attorney or any interested person may file an action to determine if past actions of the legislative body violate the act. A cease and desist letter is first appropriately served upon the legislative body, which clearly describes the past action and nature of the alleged violation. The letter is submitted within 9 months of the alleged violation, and the time during which the legislative body may respond has expired, and the legislative body has not provided an unconditional commitment. Then they can file a lawsuit. But so they have to go through all of these steps in order to do that. That unconditional acceptance is something your board would file that says, hey, we're not saying we did anything wrong, but we promise not to ever violate the Brown Act in that matter. Once you file that unconditional acceptance letter and your board approves it by a majority vote, they can't file a suit against you. But then your board can rescind that letter at some point if you decide you want to go ahead and violate the Brown Act in that manner. I don't see that ever happening. So this is just a sample, some information about that unconditional commitment. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this either, but it does prevent the lawsuit for past actions. And that letter of unconditional acceptance cannot be used against you because you're not saying I did anything wrong. You're just saying, hey, we're not going to do that going forward. Unconditional commitment, sorry. And that's it. I did that really fast. You're welcome.
Thank you, Kendra.
You're welcome.
If you have comments any questions, should we leave? Go to the bar? The bar? We have our next meeting already scheduled, June the 6th. So if we have no further business, I'll call for a motion to adjourn. Pardon me? She did. Is there a second?
I'll second.
I don't think we need a roll call. Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Kendra.
You're welcome.
Mr. Jervis.
You're welcome.
New friends.
No, that was great. You did. I was surprised.